The next thing I want to get to is how stars interact with dark matter. So suppose I have a star. There's my star. There's my ball of gas. This star is typically what's made of nuclei. For most stars, most of the nuclei are either hydrogen or helium. And if you think back to the dark matter candidates we looked at, these dark matter candidates can scatter off nuclei. So we looked at direct detection, where the dark matter hits the nucleus and so on. And what can happen with the star is my dark matter particle can be sort of moving along in its merry way. And this dark matter particle can, it'll be gravitationally attracted to the star for one thing. But if it hits the star, it might actually collide with one of the nuclei within the star. And if it collides with the nucleus inside the star, I guess one of two things could happen. It could just scatter and leave the star. But if it scatters to a velocity smaller than the escape velocity from the star at whatever point it scatters at, the dark matter particle can be captured. So the idea is that my dark matter particle, let's call it chi, scatters with something, and it scatters down to a lower energy. That lower energy is below the escape velocity from the star. And that means that after the collision, here's my collision, after the collision, the dark matter particle is effectively trapped in the star and starts to get pulled towards the middle of the star by the gravitational potential of the star. Now, typically, once the dark matter particle is initially captured, it's going to bounce around and scatter with other nuclei. And as it does, it ends up thermalizing in most cases with the nuclei within the core of the star. And the dark matter ends up settling to near the middle of the star. And the dark matter builds up in the middle of the star within a certain radius, and I'm going to call RTH. And this thermal radius develops a large dark matter density. And in the case of annihilating dark matter, that dark matter density can start annihilating and either heat up the star or shoot things out of the star that we might be able to see with telescopes. So again, the story is, we'll do a list. The dark matter scatters to some velocity less than escape velocity at whatever radius the scattering happens. More scattering thermalizes the dark matter with the rest of the star. And by thermalizes, I mean specifically it reaches the kinetic equilibrium, where the effective temperature of the dark matter particle matches the temperature of the star. And three, dark matter, once it thermalizes, collects within what I'll call a thermal sphere, set by the temperature. Now, it's easy to estimate the thermal sphere. The typical energy of a dark matter particle a typical kinetic energy from the thermal effect is essentially TC, where TC is the temperature in the core of the star. This is the typical momentum. So the typical, I'm going to go this up, but the typical energy of the dark matter particle is set by its temperature, and this should match up with the mass of the star at whatever radius is less than the dark matter particle times its mass over the given radius. And if I assume that the corresponding density within the star is roughly constant, this tells me that the radius where these two things match corresponds to what I call my thermal radius. And my thermal radius ends up looking like the temperature of the core times M Planck squared. So remember, G is roughly 1 over M Planck squared, times m chi over rho c to the 1/2, where rho c is the density of the nuclei within the star. So what you end up doing is the dark matter collects within this thermal sphere, which is typically a much smaller radius than the star itself. And the parameters of the radius of the thermosphere depend on the inner temperature and the inner density within the thermosphere. And within this thermosphere, the density of dark matter tends to be much smaller than the density of nuclei there. So the density in the core of the star is still dominated by the star itself, not the dark matter it's collected. So the thing holding the dark matter in there is the gravitational pull of the nuclei, not the self-gravitation of the dark matter itself. So this is the first step. Your star collects dark matter, and things happen. The next step is, if I collect enough dark matter, the dark matter, because it has a large density in the core of the star, can start to annihilate. And to describe this whole system, where I have capture and then subsequent annihilation, so I guess I'll put my step 4, chi annihilates. In the stellar interior. I can describe this whole process with a very simple differential equation. I just write a differential equation for dn dt, where this n is the total number of dark matter particles within the star. So it's not a density, it's a total number of dark matter particles within the whole star. And the number of dark matter particles in the star, assuming my star is in some steady state region, it's just going to collect dark matter particles at a constant rate. So I'll call that capture rate C. And then to account for annihilation is going to reduce the number of dark matter particles in the star. It turns out that this is going to be proportional to n squared. So the second piece is from annihilation, and I'll get to it in a second. So I have a simple differential equation for the number of dark matter particles in the star. The first piece, the capture rate, is related to how easily the dark matter can scatter at nuclei. So the full expression for this capture rate is very complicated. It depends on the kinematics of the scattering and the mass of the dark matter relative to the mass of the nuclei within the star and so on. But a reasonable approximate form of the capture rate looks something like this. It depends on the local dark matter number density. This shouldn't be surprising. It depends on the local dark matter velocity in the region of the star. So I can think of this combination as just a local flux of dark matter on the star. There's a kinematic factor, and the kinematic factor is, at least in certain limits, V escape squared. Goes like V escape squared over V bar squared. So V bar is the velocity of the dark matter in the region of the star. V escape corresponds to the escape velocity from the center of the star. And this factor accounts for the probability for the scattering to push the dark matter velocity after the scattering to below V escape. So this is a kinematic factor. This is a flux factor. This is the kinematic factor, corresponding to the fraction of all the collisions that scatter me to below the escape velocity. And finally, I have an effective scattering cross-section of my dark matter particle with the nuclei in the star. And this effective cross-section takes one of two forms. So my effective cross-section either looks like what you might expect just from the direct detection story. I sum over all of the nuclei I within the star, and my total effective cross section is going to depend on the total number of that I species of nucleus. So for that, I take the total mass of the star, M star, and I divide it by the mass of that specific nucleus. So this is a very big number. I also have a factor that goes like the mass fraction. So xi is the fraction of the stellar mass made up by the ith species. And ai is the atomic mass of that individual species. And then I have an effective scattering cross-section for dark matter with the ith nuclear species. So this is just a sum over the cross sections with each individual nucleus within the star, summed over all those nuclei within the star. So the mass fraction over AI tells me the relative number fraction, and this is the total number of those nuclei within the star. So I have this expression, but this only applies in one particular limit. The other limit that I get, I replace this with pi r star squared. So r star is the actual radius of the star, and what's going on here is depending on how strongly my dark matter particle interacts with the star, in a lot of cases it'll turn out that each time a dark matter hits the star, it's actually very unlikely to actually collide with anything. So if the dark matter particle is unlikely to collide with anything, most of the time it just goes through, and that's called the optically thin limit. And the dark matter most of the time just goes through, and that means that this result should apply. So going through easily means that the effective cross-section is kind of small, and the dark matter just goes through most of the time. On the other hand, the other limit is that if the scattering cross-section is big enough, each time a dark matter hits the star, it'll be captured. So the scattering cross-section could be so large that I'm likely to undergo multiple scatterings for each dark matter particle incident on here. And for that, that means that the effective cross-section is just the cross-sectional area of the star. So I get this pi r star squared. And that's called the optically thick limit. So again, this is only a very approximate form for the capture rate, but in a lot of cases it works pretty well. So that's the first part. The other piece is the annihilation piece. So I have this A coefficient, and the A coefficient is not too surprising. It's just the annihilation cross section. So I'll call it sigma V for annihilation, divided by the volume of the thermal sphere, which is just 4 pi over 3 times the thermal sphere radius cubed. So if I divide off by the volume of the star, this just reduces to something that looks like a Boltzmann equation for the number density within the star. But it's actually much easier to think about just the total number of dark matter particles in the star. What else? I haven't actually included it here, but I should also mention that in some cases, if the dark matter density gets large enough, and dark matter has a very large self-interaction cross-section, sometimes I might also have a large capture rate of the dark matter hitting another dark matter particle in the core. But this usually requires a large dark matter self-interaction, and I'm not going to worry about that for now. I'll assume that the nuclear scattering is the dominant case. And this is usually true for WIMPs. So in any case, I have this differential equation. I have my coefficient C, which depends on some particle physics stuff. I have my annihilation coefficient A, and this also depends on some particle physics stuff. But it's particle physics stuff I know how to compute. And once I have this, I can go off and solve my differential equation. And this differential equation is very easy to solve. The solution is just assuming that my star initially has no dark matter particles in it. My solution is n of t is just root c over a arctangent t over I'm trying to remember whether it should be a tan h or a tan h with a I think it's just a hyperbolic tangent.
Did you say arctangent?
Hyperbolic tangent. So this thing, if I draw this as a function of time, it asymptotes to, the tangent asymptotes to 1, and the number asymptotes to c over a.
Yeah. So this is the limit where the annihilation is in equilibrium with the capture.
Well, I'm assuming I start with no dark matter particles inside. So initially the capture dominates, but then as time goes on, the capture ends up matching the annihilation. So as n grows larger, the second term balances the first, and you can see that when this piece becomes equal to this piece, my number becomes constant, and that just corresponds to n being root c over a. So that's precisely what I have here. Now, there's also an equilibration time, this t star, and, or sorry, tau star. And tau star, the equilibration time is 1 over root CA. So we see that if we wait long enough, the capture and annihilation in a star will balance. And this is nice, because this also tells us that the rate at which dark matter particles dump energy into the star, or produce products, this means that the heating rate, and by heating rate I just mean the rate of energy deposition by dark matter, the heating rate, which I'll call dQ dt, is, well, in general, it's going to be the amount of energy per annihilation dumped by each annihilation times the annihilation rate, which is just an squared. But if I wait long enough, this heating rate asymptotes to an squared becomes equal to c. And that means that my heating rate becomes proportional to the capture rate. And this is kind of nice, because my capture rate, at least in the limit of a small nuclear reaction cross-section, my capture rate is just some combination that's proportional to the nuclear scattering. So this kind of, this effect, at least once I reach equilibrium, is actually going to be related to direct detection, because the same cross-sections come through. And once I reach equilibrium, I don't really care much about what my actual annihilation rate is. So in the equilibrium limit, the thing I care about is specifically the nuclear scattering cross-section. It turns out that for many stars of interest, the equilibrium happens fairly quickly compared to the age of the star, so that we expect that we are in the steady state limit. Let me just mention one additional effect that I haven't included here. And the additional effect, I'll put it here, is something called evaporation. And what evaporation means is that I have dark matter bouncing around in a sphere, but I also have a Maxwell distribution of temperatures in the core, and sometimes I can have a thermal scattering within the core that's way out on the tail of the Maxwell distribution, and that can actually kick the dark matter particle up to an energy larger than the escape velocity, and that particle can escape from the star. Now, The reason this can happen is that, at least in the optically thin limit, once I give the dark matter particle a kick, it's not likely to scatter again in the star. So if I give a big kick to a dark matter particle within the star and it doesn't scatter very much, it can get out. If I was to do the same thing to a nucleus, the nucleus would end up running into other nuclei and it wouldn't get out. So dark matter is a little bit special in terms of this evaporation. Now, computing this E coefficient is a bit tricky. And it turns out that in most cases of interest, evaporation isn't actually interesting. This is just a tiny correction to the rest of the story that we don't care about. In the case of the sun, evaporation is something you don't have to worry about unless your dark matter particle is lighter than, I don't know, 3 or 4 GeV or so. But I'm just mentioning it as something to keep in mind if you're considering theories with very light dark matter. Okay. So this is the story. This is a story that applies very generally to stars. But let me give you a few specific examples to show how this might be observable in practice. So the star that we're most interested in is the sun, simply because it's our own familiar one. And for the sun, you can show that the age of the sun, which I'll call T O dot, is greater than the equilibration rate for dark matter, provided the annihilation cross-section is big enough. So this piece is the scattering cross section of the dark matter off a proton. This is the annihilation rate. Is there any question?
So T is the age of the sun, current age of the sun?
Yeah, the current age of the sun. So the current age of the sun is about 5 billion years. And we think the lifetime of the sun is more like 10 billion years. So we still have a good 5 billion years left. But it's long enough that as long as my annihilation rate is reasonably vague, I'll equilibrate. Okay, so in the case of the sun, dark matter annihilation can heat it up, but the amount of heating that you would expect from dark matter, given our local dark matter density, isn't very big. So heating the sun by dark matter doesn't seem to be an issue. The interesting signal you get from the sun, though, are the products from the dark matter annihilation itself. So the picture here is we have our sun, and here's my thermal sphere of dark matter in the middle of the sun. So that's my thermal sphere. And so suppose I have a dark matter annihilation in the sun. Most of the things that dark matter will annihilate into will either decay or get trapped in the sun. But the thing dark matter can produce that can get out of the sun is a neutrino. So suppose I have an annihilation of dark matter that produces a neutrino. The neutrino can get out and then travel a long way. And eventually, this neutrino can reach us on the Earth. Now, the neutrinos we would expect from WIMP dark matter have energies sort of typically in the range of the WIMP mass. So energies in the range of, let's say, 10 to 100 GeV or so. And 10 to 100 GeV is a very high neutrino energy compared to the neutrinos we normally get from the sun, which are produced by nuclear processes, or most of the neutrinos you get from just regular cosmic ray production. So the point is we can get a very high energy flux of neutrinos from dark matter annihilation in the sun, and we can look for this in detectors. And the way you look for this in a detector is here's the Earth. You take a detector that's underground. So here's my underground detector. And you look for not the neutrino specifically, but what happens when the neutrino hits something near the detector. And that's an upward going muon. So the idea is that your neutrino hits a nucleus, and it produces junk plus a muon. So the idea is my neutrino travels through the Earth, where it's unlikely to hit anything. But if I'm lucky, it's going to hit something here and produce a muon. And this muon, I can observe in my detector. And the reason you look specifically for upward-going high-energy muons is that the downward-going muons have a background from cosmic rays. So the idea is you look for an upward-going muon flux. And these muons have to be pretty energetic. And lots of experiments have looked for this. And assuming that the sun has equilibrated and making assumptions about how the dark matter annihilates, you can actually get some pretty interesting limits on the dark matter direct detection cross-section from the fact that we haven't so far seen an excess in upward going muon flux, I guess.
Whether it's upward going or downward going will depend on its scale micro.
Yeah. So you look for this at night. But actually, the sun might not be the only source. And actually, you can have a similar story of capture of dark matter in the Earth. And if you capture dark matter in the Earth, it'll annihilate within the Earth's core, and then produce the same thing. And this doesn't actually have to be at night. So you may as well look for the thing at the whole time. But if you want to correlate it with the sun, then yes, it has to be. Has to more or less happen at the right time. So in any case, the fact that we haven't seen an excess of upward-going muons means that I can translate the flux limit into a limit on my effective capture rate of dark matter, assuming that I've reached a steady state. So the story here looks something like this. If I assume that the dark matter scattering is primarily spin dependent, people do this partly because it makes the limits look stronger. But as a function of 1, 10, as a function of the dark matter mass, you can get different limits on the dark matter direct detection from not seeing this. So the limits from direct detection look something like that. So this is the direct detection limit. On the other hand, the limit from not seeing too many upper going muons looks something like, I'll get some colored chalk, it is actually a little bit stronger at higher energies. So I get limits like this from not seeing an upper going muon flux. And the limit also depends on how the dark matter annihilates. So I'm trying to reproduce this. So this upper limit assumes that I have chi-chi versus dV bar. And this lower limit corresponds to dark matter chi-chi goes to W plus W minus. So each of these annihilation modes will produce neutrinos as products at the end of the day. But the energy spectrum of those neutrinos and how many neutrinos I get depend on what the specific product is. So this is sort of like 10 to the minus 39 centimeters squared. And I can actually get some stronger bounds from not seeing too much flux from the sun. But these stronger bounds also make assumptions about how the dark matter annihilates. If the dark matter annihilates in some other ways, so for example, if the dark matter, let's say the dark matter annihilates entirely into electrons or muons, if it annihilates into electrons, I don't really get neutrinos in the first place. If it annihilates into muons, what ends up happening is the muon comes out of the dark matter decay with a lot of energy, so the dark matter annihilation with a lot of energy, but muons actually live a long time. And what happens for muons is that the muon would go out and would actually get stuck in the sun and come to a stop in the sun before it produces a neutrino in its decay. So in this case, with the muons, instead of getting a neutrino with the energy of the full dark matter mass, your neutrino energy is more like the mass of the muon, and that's too small to see. Because the experiments look for this, specifically IceCube and SuperK, which are deep underground neutrino detectors, these experiments have lower thresholds on their sensitivity to the upper going muon energies, around 10 GeV or so. So these limits are strong for these specific annihilation modes, but there are other annihilation modes that wouldn't even give a signal. So we should still do the spin-dependent searches, even though it seems like these limits are stronger. These limits are also model-dependent. Okay, so this is the sun, and if you recall, the sun is a main sequence star. But there are lots of other main sequence stars, and you can have another main sequence stars may live in places where there's a really big local dark matter density. And when there's a large dark matter density, I can get a much larger capture rate, because notice the capture rate is proportional to the local dark matter density. For main sequence stars, it turns out that the heating of the star can have an important effect. But the effect's really complicated, and it's not really fully understood. But it can be important for main sequence stars near the center of the galaxy where you have large dark matter densities. There's another fun case, though, which could be interesting and observable, which is neutron stars or white dwarfs. And the signal here is a little bit different. The signal for these stars, which if you recall are basically just balls of nuclei held up by degeneracy pressure, the story for these stars is that the story for these stars is that since they're supported by degeneracy pressure instead of nuclear fusion, if I wait long enough, they'll just cool off. So these are essentially, well, they have lots of interesting dynamics, but in a broad brush, they're just sitting there cooling off. So what we expect for a neutron star or a white dwarf is that if we look at the temperature of that star as a function of time, what we expect is that it's just going to fall off. And it just falls off as this neutron star cools and emits radiation. So yes?
They cool off by emitting radiation?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So this is what I expect for a regular neutron star or a regular white dwarf. But what can happen if I have dark matter is that at some point, the heating from the dark matter, which if the dark matter equilibrates, will reach a constant rate. This constant heating rate can lead to a constant temperature that isn't just a falling thing. So with dark matter, I'll fall off for a while, but then the dark matter heating takes over, and I just go to a constant. So that's with dark matter. Without dark matter, and the story here is what you want to look for are neutron stars that are old enough that you would have expected them to cool off a whole lot, and that are also in regions where you're pretty sure that the local dark matter density is very large. And here, it's not so much a matter of finding dark matter as it is if you see a neutron star colder than what you'd expect from the dark matter heating, you can actually rule out dark matter, or at least rule out dark matter with a certain density in the neighborhood of that star. So there's an interesting story here, and people are trying to do this observationally. The only tricky part, though, is it turns out that for neutron stars that are cold, as the temperature of the neutron star goes down, typically so does its luminosity. And they become harder and harder to see. And the problem is that these cold neutron stars without dark matter just become hard to see, and it's hard to find one that would give us some information about dark matter or not. Now, okay, this is most of what I wanted to say about dark matter and stars, but let me just also mention a slightly unusual case. And that is, suppose I have dark matter that doesn't annihilate or annihilates only really, really weakly. In that case, instead of equilibrating, the number of dark matter particles is just going to build up and build up and build up. And this kind of thing can happen, for example, if I have, for example, asymmetric dark matter, where the density of dark matter doesn't come from thermal freezeout, but it comes from an asymmetry between dark matter and its distinct antimatter particle. So I only have dark matter, not anti-dark matter. And in this case, only dark matter, the only annihilation is between dark matter and anti-dark matter. So no annihilation occurs. In that limit, where I essentially turn off the annihilation, the dark matter just builds up and builds up and builds up. And what can happen in this case is if I build up too much dark matter, the dark matter can start to self-gravitate. And if there's nothing to stabilize the dark matter from collapsing because of its self-gravitation, I can actually form a black hole induced by the dark matter in the interior of the star. So there are actually some interesting limits on asymmetric dark matter or non-annihilating dark matter from the fact that it can build up a very large density and form a black hole that would engulf the neutron star or the white dwarf. So the point is, because we see neutron stars or white dwarfs in regions where we think there's a lot of dark matter, we can put limits on this kind of possibility. I should also mention a loophole, though, in that in some of these theories, I might also have a repulsive dark matter self-interaction. And a repulsive dark matter self-interaction can also support and create a pressure that can prevent the collapse. But if specifically I have an asymmetric dark matter particle that doesn't have a self-interaction or has an attractive self-interaction, it can form a black hole and eat neutron stars. So I'm going to change gears here. I'm going to change gears and go from outer space to lab experiments. So I'm going to change gears and start talking about dark matter at colliders. So I finished with dark matter and stars. And there's actually sort of a popular, it's kind of a propaganda plot, but I'll draw it for you anyhow. The propaganda plot is, suppose I draw my generic picture for dark matter direct detection. So you can think of this as a Feynman diagram. And if I think of this as a Feynman diagram with time going this way, this corresponds to direct detection. On the other hand, if I think of this as a Feynman diagram with time going this way, this corresponds to indirect detection from dark matter annihilation. And the story of dark matter colliders is I just think of time, I just view this as a Feynman diagram of time going this way, and this is the story of colliders. I collide two standard model particles to produce two dark matter particles. So that's what I'll get to next. Just one question. In any of the previous courses, did you talk about the LHC or hadron colliders at all? Or parton distribution functions or anything like that? But I guess maybe not everybody took the course. Okay, I'll just give you a
parton distribution function
briefly. In a standard model course?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll just give a very quick overview. So the story of colliders is that the best colliders we have now are hadron colliders. And by hadron, I mean protons or antiprotons. So for example, we have the LHC. So the LHC is a PP collider that collides stuff at root s of, at the moment, 7 or 8 TeV. And recently, until recently, we had also the Tevatron. And this collided protons with antiprotons at root s of about, I think it's 1.96 TeV. This turned off recently. The LHC has collected a lot of data. The Tevatron also has a fair bit of data. And what happens in each of these collisions is, I'm colliding protons. But as we all know, protons aren't elementary particles. They're made of smaller stuff. So protons or antiprotons are made of quarks, antiquarks, and gluons. And there's a big mixture. And when I collide these guys, most of the time they're not going to do much. Most of the time, the quarks and gluons within these objects just pass through each other, and I just have some soft, fuzzy thing, and not much happens. But every so often, if I'm lucky, one of the constituents of the proton, or antiproton, will collide with another one of the constituents. So instead of having just kind of like a fuzzy cloud pass through each other, the hard things within the cloud can run into each other and have a hard scattering. So the story here is the partons, and the parton is a generic name for any of the quarks, antiquarks, or gluons within the hadron. Every so often, the partons can collide, and I can think of this process as I have my proton coming in here, and I'm drawing this as a Feynman diagram. Here's my proton, and this is some complicated object. But every so often, I can have, let's say, a quark and an antiquark in this object collide. And so, for example, for a Wimp dark matter, I could produce a Z, and then I could have coming out a pair of dark matter particles. So here's a quark, another quark, and this proton-proton collision. Every so often, I can get a parton collision. That this hard parton collision produces dark matter particles. I won't get into it, but you can compute the total cross-section for this process by convolving the cross-section for the quark-quark scattering with what are called parton distribution functions, which tell you the probability of having a given parton within each hadron having a given momentum. Okay, but I guess the one point I want to make about the story is that even though these colliders are colliding protons or antiprotons in the hadron center mass frame, the collision between the partonic constituents, the quarks, antiquarks, and gluons, in general, those guys, even though in the lab frame the proton-proton center of mass is zero, the center of mass of the parton-parton collision might not be zero. So I might have a net boost along the beam axis in the partonic collision. And in general, I don't know what that boost is. And that means that if I want to use the usual tricks of applying momentum conservation, I can only apply momentum conservation transverse to the beam axis. So in other words, if this is my beam, I can only apply momentum conservation in the transverse plane. So this is what we end up doing. In these colliders, we have the beams come together. The beams collide, and stuff happens. And we put a big detector to measure the stuff that happens. And what we measure are particle momenta. So here's PI for some visible particle coming out of the collision. And the point is that for applying momentum conservation, we always project this momentum onto the transverse plane. So we turn this PI into its transverse projection. We call PT, I. So that's the first thing. The other thing is that if I specialize specifically to dark matter, I have a bit of a problem. Dark matter, because it doesn't have any color charge and doesn't have any electric charge, turns out not to interact at all with the collider detectors at the LHC. So that means that when I create dark matter, I don't actually see the dark matter particles directly, but I can still use momentum conservation tricks to see them indirectly. So the idea is that when I produce dark matter chi, this dark matter particle will carry some momentum and energy from the event. So one of the signals for dark matter is so-called missing energy and missing momentum. And the idea is that, so here's my transverse plane. Here's my beam axis. Suppose I produce two visible particles with these momenta, so-called P1, P2, I would also have momenta for the dark matter, but I don't see the dark matter momenta. So what I end up measuring is some net momentum in the transverse plane that that seems to be imbalanced. So what I define and what I think of as my signal of my signature of dark matter is so-called missing momentum. And the missing momentum is I sum over all the visible objects in the event. I sum over their PTs. And when these things don't add up to zero, something else must be carrying off the momentum. And I can identify that with dark matter, or possibly other stuff like standard model neutrinos, or just my detector not working right. But one of the specific signals of dark matter is this missing momentum. And I'll also define the missing transverse energy as just the magnitude of the missing transverse momentum vector. Okay. So my signal of dark matter is going to be this quantity. That's the first bit. Now, if I think about, I'm running out of blackboard here. If there are two cases I want to talk about for actually producing dark matter. So the first case for producing dark matter is specific to supersymmetry or theories like supersymmetry. So in the supersymmetric case, my chi is my lightest neutralino. And this is the lightest superpartner. And it can be stable because of R parity. But in general, this lightest superpartner is not the particle that I tend to produce most at hadron colliders. Instead, because of the largeness of the strong coupling, the particles I tend to produce at hadron colliders are the superpartners of the quarks and gluons. So the story at a hadron collider is that my PP collision is going to produce mostly things like squark-squark or squark-gluino or gluino-gluino. And these are the superpartners of the gluons and the squarks and so on. So the gluons and the quarks. But when I produce these guys, because of R parity, these guys are going to decay in a cascade. So for example, suppose I produce a spork. The spork tends to decay to my LSP and a quark. And in the case of in the case of a gluino, my gluino likes to decay to a gluon and the LSP, possibly in other ways. But the point is that whenever I produce one of the pairs of these objects, they're going to decay in a cascade and produce some visible stuff. But the cascade is going to end up at the lightest superpartner, no matter what happens. So the upshot of all this is that these cascade decays are going to give me some visible things, but also missing energy from the LSPs. So what I can do is look for events with lots of missing energy. And this is what's done. If I count the number of events, and I plot it as a function of the missing energy per event, what I would expect from standard model stuff is some falling function. So as I mentioned, the standard model does predict some missing energy, but not all that much. So the standard model gives you missing energy from things like neutrinos produced by vector bosons, or also just some imperfections in the detector. On the other hand, if I have supersymmetric events, what I would expect for supersymmetry is something with actually much more missing energy. So my expectation for supersymmetry is that at large missing energy, I should have I should see more events. So I'll run that. And this is precisely what people look for. You go out, you look for events with some very hard QCD jets. So QCD jet is what you get out of a high energy quark gluon, and you also get missing energy. And in events with hard QCD jets and missing energy, I look out on the tail and look for an excess. So any question?
I was just wondering, you know, the x axis is in GeV, but I was wondering, you know, what are the actual values for the standard model?
Yeah. Well, so it's the specific form of these plots or of these curves depend on what other requirements I put on the events. So typically you'll focus only on events with, let's say, at least two jets with PT larger than 500 GeV and missing energy larger than some amount, and then I show a distribution as a function of missing ET for those. So it's hard to put an overall scale without specifying what else is going on. In any case, so far we haven't seen any hints from this kind of search. And because of that, we have limits on supersymmetry. And the limits we get on supersymmetry are typically quoted as limits on Skork and gluino masses. And these have to be larger than roughly 1.5 TeV or so, given the current constraints. So this is a very strong bound. It doesn't rule out supersymmetry as an interesting possibility, but it's starting to constrain it in an important way. But at the same time, these searches probe primarily the skorks and the gluons. They're not as sensitive to the actual mass of the dark matter particle. So I could still have, for example, a neutralino LSP with a mass of about 100 GeV, even though these states have to be much heavier. So if you like, this is a somewhat indirect way to look for dark matter at colliders. There's also a nice, more direct way, and that's what I want to do next. So first of all, this is indirect, and second of all, it's fairly specific to supersymmetry, or theories kind of like supersymmetry. But the other more direct way is to use something called monojets or related techniques. So here, the processes we're studying are specifically proton-proton goes to, for example, skork, and then I have quark LSP, quark LSP. So this is the kind of event these Suzy searches look for. What I could try to do instead, though, is look at my proton-proton collision. And look at the production of the dark matter directly. So I just collide protons, and I look for dark matter particles to come out on their own. And this seems nice, as I'm making the dark matter directly. I don't care about any intermediate states. The only problem with this, though, is that this is a nice collision, but I don't actually see these dark matter particles. So in other words, I collide protons, but I don't see the products of that collision. So on its own, this is invisible. So this is kind of a problem. But fortunately, we can go back and think a little bit harder about QCD. And what can happen in QCD is that on top of this kind of contribution, so let me just give you a specific example. I could have this kind of thing could come from a proton-proton collision where I spit out, my hard collision is actually quark-antiquark. It goes to a Z. It goes to chi-chi. So here's an example of a kind of thing that can contribute. What can happen every so often is I can also radiate off an extra QCD object from the colored side of the diagram. So sometimes I can also radiate, for example, in this diagram, I can also have a higher order diagram where I spit off a gluon. And there's a cost for this. And the cost for this is that in the basic of event without the extra QCD thing, I'm going to call this zero jet. And in the case of the cross section with the hard QCD object, I'll call this the one jet because I have one visible QCD jet. And roughly, my one jet cross section goes like the zero jet cross section times the value of the strong coupling. Specifically, the value of the PT of the hard jet coming out. So this is the strong coupling. This is GS squared over 4 pi. And numerically, it's roughly about 0.1. So a 0.1 is not a huge number, but it's also not a super tiny number. And because it's not too small, a reasonable fraction of all my events are going to have these hard extra jets. So what I can look for are events where I have one hard QCD jet, but nothing else. So one hard QCD jet and nothing else is called a monojet. And to get a hard monojet, the jet has to recoil off invisible things like dark matter, possibly also neutrinos. But this also turns out to be a nice way to look for dark matter directly. And in some cases, as long as the dark matter is not too heavy, we can actually relate the monojet limits to direct detection. I'm going to have to start erasing here. Okay, so as long as my collision energy isn't too high, I can do what I did for direct detection and write an effective interaction between dark matter and quarks that has a form of, in the case of a fermionic dark matter, some higher dimensional operator. So these gammas are Dirac structures. So for example, if I have gamma equals 1, gamma 1 equals 1, gamma 2 equals 1, I would have the scalar-scalar operator. If I had gamma mu, that would be vector-vector, and so on. So I can look at VV, AA, SS, or whatever, VP, or even mixtures, or whatever. But these operators, these operators will also mediate dark matter scattering. Yes.
So what is P?
Pseudoscalar. So that'd be just a gamma 5.
Could we have, say, gamma mu mu?
Yeah, that'd be a tensor. But well, depending on what you have, some direct structures can be turned into other ones by Stewart's rearrangement.
Yeah, but that would be the three gammas would be
yeah. One gamma. Yeah. Okay, there are other possibilities, but. But the point is, this operator contributes to direct detection, but if I turn it on its side, it also contributes to this dark matter production process. And we can actually do a very crude order of magnitude estimate for the cross sections. For direct detection, the single nucleon cross section I would expect, just based on dimensional analysis, would be the dark matter proton reduced mass divided by lambda to the fourth. Whereas the cross-section for the one jet, the monojet cross-section, I'm going to have a factor of alpha s. But by dimensional analysis, I'm going to have, okay, so I guess it'll have two limits. I can have pt squared over lambda to the fourth in the limit of pt much, much less than lambda. Or I can have 1 over pt squared for pt larger than about lambda. But in this limit, I probably shouldn't trust this picture anyhow. So forget about this. Let's concentrate on this. In this case, if I compare this rate to this rate, what I see is that the one jet cross section looks something like alpha s times pt over mu p squared sigma direct detection. And just very naively, this is a very crude estimate, but very naively, this thing can be a very large number. And the upshot of this is that the fact that I get an enhancement of this kind of interaction at high energies means that the collider search can actually be more sensitive than the direct detection search. So people have sat down and studied this carefully. And I'm just going to summarize the results. To get the results, you basically just take this operator, plug it in, and compute cross sections and compare. You can compare the results from spin independent scattering as a function of the dark matter mass, and the direct detection limits look something like this. The current limits from the LHC depend on what kind of operator you have. So if my operator is, let's see what they assume. If I have, for example, a vector operator with QQ, my collider limit looks something like this. So the collider limit is I have to live above here. The direct detection limit is I have to live above here. So we see that in the spin-independent case, even though direct detection is better at larger masses, at smaller masses below about this is about 10 GeV, kind of like 100 GeV, the collider bounds actually get better for the lighter dark matter masses. But this assumes a spin-independent scattering where I have a large cross section. I should also mention that in the case of a in the case of a gluon coupling, I can actually get a relatively stronger bound. So this is the spin independent case. In the spin dependent case, my direct detection bounds are again kind of this white line that I have to live above. And in this case, because I get less of an enhancement in the effect of total nuclear cross-section for spin-dependent scattering, the collider bounds are actually stronger. So this is the collider bound, for example, for chi bar, gamma mu, gamma 5, chi, gamma mu, gamma 5, q. So for the axial-axial operator, I actually get much stronger bounds that actually extend to much lower dark matter masses than I do from direct detection. So there's a very interesting relation between direct detection and these direct collider searches that, for one, make some of these spin-dependent results look a bit depressing. I should also mention, though, that there is a way out of this. And this kind of limit assumes that whatever's mediating the dark matter quark interaction can be parameterized in terms of a higher dimensional operator. And this is only valid if my mediator, whatever's mediating the interaction, is very heavy. If I have a light mediator, it turns out that these bounds get much, much weaker. This bound gets much weaker. This bound gets much weaker. And actually, I'm typically pushed to a limit more like this. I don't get the same enhancement. And in that case, the direct detection bounds are better. So I'm going to wrap it up there. I guess come back tomorrow, and I'll cover axions with dark matter. And I think that'll wrap up the course. I'll give you your last homework tomorrow as well. And I guess you have a tutorial with Tuper today.